Tian, Executive Director of FAM, the Family Action Network Movement. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gezder, Nirmin Sheikh, Carla Wills, Sami Warnoff, Sam Alcock, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, and Amy Goodman.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Don't Look Back on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Don't Look Back is a documentary film following Bob Dylan during a three-week concert tour of England in the spring of 1965. The film chronicles Dylan's concert appearances, hotel room conversations, and downtime, pulling back the curtain on Dylan on the cusp of his creative shift towards rock music. Again, that's Don't Look Back on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, human trafficking continues.
And a Green New Deal takes a new step forward.
And international news, yellow vests in France and the regulations of protests.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January the 10th, 2019. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. We have a trigger alert for this story, which is about human sex trafficking. In Multnomah County, an investigation of a convicted felon means prison time for 31 years as an older man. The district attorney announced today that Marvin Glenn Mitchell will get 5 years and 9 months following a Portland police investigation. Mitchell pleaded guilty to promoting prostitution, assault, and domestic violence. He admitted that in March of 2017, he facilitated and promoted the sex trafficking of two females. Mitchell also confessed to injuring one of the females in the presence of a child. Investigators learned that Mitchell first met one of the victims in 2006 when he was 18 years old. The victim was in middle school at the time. The two became involved in a relationship. And, quote, "This was a vulnerable young girl, and Marvin Mitchell took advantage of that fact," Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney Mike Botoff said after the sentencing. And, quote, "He started to groom the victim. He told her that if she helped him make money, then he'd buy her nice clothing. That's when he started to promote her into selling her body for sex on Burnside Street and 82nd Avenue in Portland." Multnomah Circuit Court Judge Karen Immigrant said Mitchell's actions and, quote, "harmed two young women very seriously." Mitchell's ordered to register as a sex offender. He was already ordered to register after a prostitution conviction in 2010.
Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer has introduced a bill that would legalize weed nationwide. The Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol Act would remove cannabis from the Drug Enforcement Agency's list of Schedule I drugs. Now, Schedule I drugs also include heroin, LSD, and ecstasy, among others. If approved, the bill known as H.R. 420 would place marijuana under the control of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and create a nationally regulated industry. Blumenauer is the Democratic representative from Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. He's a founder of the Congressional Cannabis Caucus and a longtime supporter of marijuana legalization. In a tweet, the congressman says the objective is to, quote, end senseless prohibition and ensure restorative justice for those impacted by the war on drugs, end quote. He urged voters across the country to ask their representatives to support the bill. Blumenauer told an interviewer from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws that, quote, while the bill number may be a bit tongue-in-cheek, the issue is very serious. Our federal marijuana laws are outdated, end of quote. The likelihood of this bill passing the House and Senate and President Trump signing it into law is unknown.
The White House is asking the Army Corps of Engineers to look into the disaster relief projects for money that could be used for a border wall with Mexico. Multiple sources report President Trump is laying the groundwork for declaring an immigration national emergency to build his border wall. Trump calls it a growing humanitarian and security crisis, even though many experts and lawmakers dispute this. Trump and Democratic members of Congress are at odds as he demands $5.7 billion for the wall, and they refuse to give him the money. This has resulted in the government shutdown that is now in its third week. As of tomorrow, it will tie for the longest government shutdown in U.S. history.
For thousands of government workers affected by the partial federal government shutdown, tomorrow will be their first day they don't get a paycheck. The Northwest Credit Union Association says its credit unions are standing by to help their members who are affected. They're offering things like short-term low-interest loans, lower-interest credit cards, financial counseling, and loan payment delays. It's a challenge to manage expenses without pay. If you're a federal worker or contractor, alert your credit union and find out what options are available, said Lynn Hyder with the Northwest Credit Union Association. That association represents more than 180 not-for-profit credit unions in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, and their 7.3 million members.
President Donald Trump has shut down the U.S. government over his demand for $5.7 billion to build a wall along our southern border. On Tuesday evening, he took to the airwaves during prime time to paint a grim picture of violent immigrants storming our southern borders. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts and a couple of questions.
I didn't listen to the 45th president's primetime address on Tuesday night. The building I live in was discussing how to install electric vehicle charging stations, and that seemed much more impactful than listening to the orange sphincter repeat his outrageous distortions about the crisis on our southern border. I did YouTube his speech after the fact and saw that despite his efforts to appear presidential, he still couldn't stop himself from lying endlessly.
Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. Our southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Over the years, thousands of Americans have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered our country, and thousands more lives will be lost if we don't act right now.
By now, we all know the number of illegal border crossings was the lowest in years in 2018. Most undocumented immigrants arrive by plane and overstay their visa. Most drugs come into the country through legal ports of entry, with the highest percentage of heroin and fentanyl coming from China. And crime statistics show that native-born Americans are much more likely to commit crimes than undocumented immigrants. Without hordes of cheering worshippers, Trump's speech was a lackluster series of lies punctuated by occasional snorts, not unlike a feral pig. The Democrats had an opportunity to present a response, but even though it was factually more relevant than Trump's, it was equally uninspired.
The President of the United States, having failed to get Mexico to pay for his ineffective, unnecessary border wall, and unable to convince the Congress or the American people to foot the bill, has shut down the government. American democracy doesn't work that way. We don't govern by temper tantrum. No president should pound the table and demand he gets his way, or else the government shuts down, hurting millions of Americans who are treated as leverage.
Not surprisingly, the only politician to respond with an adequate level of righteous indignation was once again Bernie Sanders.
It gives me no pleasure to tell you what most of you already know, and that is that President Trump lies all of the time. Trump has told the American people several hundred times, and he mentioned it tonight, that Mexico would pay for the wall. That's a lie. Trump said that thousands and thousands of terrorists are entering the United States from the southern border. That is also a lie.
Bernie also pointed out that the bill to fund the government and end the shutdown that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was refusing to bring to a vote was the same bill that had passed the Senate unanimously in December.
This is the same bill that Mr. McConnell supported when it was unanimously passed in the Senate. Senator McConnell, let's vote to end the shutdown now in a bipartisan way.
When all is said and done, Tuesday's positioning by the two parties did nothing to end the legislative logjam that has cut off paychecks to over 800,000 government employees and ground the government to a halt. For me, however, it does raise two other questions. The first is a little bit facetious. Why would the commercial networks give Trump his primetime opportunity to spout this insane nonsense? Everyone knew ahead of time it would be just an effort to reconnect to his rabid base. The second question is more concerning. How do we circumvent Republican fawning over this moronic president and Mitch McConnell's cynical control of the legislative agenda? A caller during Tuesday's Abe and Joe talk show referred to McConnell as sinister. I think they nailed it. And something has to be done. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
A joint terrorism task force investigation has led to the arrest and indictment of a former Portland resident accused of using social media to threaten Mayor Ted Wheeler. On Wednesday, the U.S. Attorney's Office unsealed a one-page indictment charging former city resident Kermit Tyler Paulson with using Instagram to threaten Wheeler with extortion. Officers arrested the 39-year-old Paulson in Missoula, Montana on January 8th when he went to police to file a complaint in an unrelated manner. Missoula police discovered Paulson's federal arrest warrant in the National Crime Information Center database, and they took him into custody right there. If he's found guilty, Paulson could get 2 years in prison and have to pay a fine of $250,000. Ironically, this action came as the city council gets ready to discuss whether to pull the Portland police out of the anti-terrorism alliance that includes FBI agents as well as a number of state and local law enforcement officers. The task force also includes officers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, which enforces immigration laws. New Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty campaigned on a promise of pulling Portland out of the JTTF as one of her first official actions. Commissioners Chloe Udaly and Amanda Fritz have indicated they're willing to consider withdrawing from the JTTF because of its association with ICE.
A sewer line clogged with debris overflowed today from a manhole on the south border of Dixon Park and woods in southwest Portland, reaching a creek in the park. The city's Environmental Services Department is telling people to avoid contact with the creek for 72 hours because of the possibility of increased bacteria in the water. They've posted warning signs at the site. City crews found sewage overflowing from a manhole on the southwest 57th Avenue. They stopped the leak around 2:45 this afternoon and cleaned the area. Sewage overflows often are preventable. Pipes that become blocked with grease, tree roots, and debris are the most common cause of sewage overflows. Environmental Services advises people to place grease in a container and then in the trash, not down kitchen drains. Avoid flushing rags or wipes or anything other than toilet paper and human waste in toilets. And outside the home, avoid pouring anything down storm drains, which are intended for rainfall only. About a third of Portland's 2,500 miles of sewer pipes are more than 80 years old.
After hearing from almost 4,000 local people so far, Vancouver has decided on Columbia and Daniel Streets and Lincoln Avenue as possible spots for better bike routes between Burnt Bridge Creek and downtown on the west side of the city. Now the city wants to hear from you about the three possible spots at several informal public gatherings in January and February. City staff is going to host two West Side Bike Mobility Project coffee talks, one from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 16th at Boomerang at 808 Main Street, the other from 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Saturday, January 19th at La Di Da, 205 East 39th Street. The city is going to hold an open house for the project from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 23rd at the Vancouver Housing Authority. You can visit the City of Vancouver's website to get more information about the project, and you can also take a new online survey about the concepts that will be available starting tomorrow.
U.S. carbon emissions spiked this year to their highest level in 8 years. According to a study by the Rhodium Group, the study attributed this rise to an increased reliance on natural gas. The emissions spike was also attributed to the Trump administration's massive rollback of environmental regulations.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Sankar Rahman and Jim Lamassen about their efforts to highlight the true life stories of immigrants in our community. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather calls for cloudy but dry weather with a low temperature of about 42. And tomorrow, Friday, we can look forward to a partly sunny day with a high in the low 50s. On this date, back in 1918, the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation for women's suffrage. The 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote was finally signed into law on August 26, 1920. The quote of the day is from immigrant and former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who said, quote, "It took me quite a long time to develop a voice, and now that I have it, I am not going to be silent."
Over 600 environmental groups called on Congress today to fully transition the U.S. from fossil fuels by 2035. In a letter, the groups urged House leaders to pass a, and quote, Green New Deal, which would phase out the economy's reliance on the fossil fuel industry.
John Nettleton, a former Guantanamo Bay commanding officer, was charged today in connection with the death of a
civilian employee, Christopher Tour. That's John Nettleton, a former Guantanamo Bay commanding officer, charged today. The charges include obstruction of justice, concealment of evidence, falsifying records, and providing false statements to police. Prosecutors say Nettleton misled investigators after he got into a fight with 42-year-old Christopher Tour, who was later found drowned in the waters off Guantanamo Bay in January of 2015. The incident kicked off at a party at the Guantanamo Officers Club, where Tur yelled at his spouse and Nettleton accused them of having an affair, according to the indictment.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem says she wants to build relationships with tribal communities, but a Native American lawmaker says her stance on the Keystone XL pipeline will further strain relations. The governor mentioned tribes and the project this week in her address to the legislature. Lee Strubinger reports.
Republican Governor Kristi Noem says she wants to build state-tribal relations. She says those bonds could address challenges tribes face in education, law and order, and economic development. But the only other time tribes were mentioned during her State of the State address was in relation to pending construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. The route will pass nearby several of the state's reservation borders. During her speech, Noem indicated issues could arise during her tenure that will require the strength and resolve of the state's first responders, military, and law enforcement. She says they are training and preparing for any kind of actions taken against pipeline construction.
Let me be very clear on this. I want the construction of this pipeline to be safe, clean, and efficient. We will make sure that our people, our water, and our environment are protected. My administration will work with the tribes, the companies, and the necessary, and if necessary, law enforcement to make this as uneventful as possible.
State Senator Troy Heinert is the minority leader and a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He says it will take a lot of work to build trust between communities.
I heard her stance on the Keystone Pipeline. You know, that is not a very popular stance in tribal communities. So getting to work on that, and we want people to be safe as well. We don't want to see anyone injured if this was to go through. But if we're gonna talk about creating habitats and conservation, then I also think it's fair that they listen to our concerns as well.
The Keystone XL project is tied up in the courts, and pipeline construction is halted. I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre, South Dakota.
Protests were held across Canada this week after the arrests of several Indigenous people in British Columbia who are opposing a pipeline. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
From Vancouver to Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, and as far as Halifax on the East Coast, people marched in support of the anti-pipeline protesters who were arrested. That came after Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers took apart a gate that blocked access to a site where a natural gas pipeline is to be built. The pipeline is part of a $40 billion project aimed at carrying liquefied natural gas from British Columbia to Asia. Protesters ignored court orders to take down access barriers, and that's when police moved in, taking 14 into custody. John Ridsdale is a hereditary chief of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation. He says he was shocked and angered that police moved in on the barrier.
It is our responsibility to look after the land. We need clean water, clean air, clean land. We need access. This is how we teach our children for the future, to look after this. Now, if you restrict us the way that they're doing it right now, how could we teach them the proper way to honor and respect land and each other?
Elsewhere, protesters even stormed a venue where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was to speak. After changing the venue, Trudeau finally got to speak.
There's a lot of work ahead of us. I don't want to dwell on the past, but you know and I know that previous governments and institutions spent years ignoring your communities and your concerns.
The pipeline issue has split many First Nations in the region, and even within the Wet'suwet'en. Experts say one of the issues is the main difference between elected and hereditary Indigenous governments. Band councils run reserves and services, but hereditary chiefs control activities on traditional territories. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Tomorrow marks the 17th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Guantanamo currently holds 40 Muslim men, many of whom were tortured. Some of these detainees have been cleared for transfers for years, but still remain there. Amnesty International USA will join other human rights organizations at a rally in Washington, D.C.'s Lafayette Park tomorrow at 2:30 to call for closing that prison.
The State Attorney General's office is planning to introduce a bill in the upcoming legislative session that would strengthen the Oregon's hate crime laws. Citing reports from the Southern Poverty Law Center on the hate-motivated incidents in the aftermath of Donald Trump's election, showing Oregon had more incidents than anywhere else, Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum said the available data all point to a growing problem that's especially bad in Oregon. FBI statistics show a 40% increase in hate crimes between 2016 and 2017. On behalf of the Portland Scanner newspaper, Ellen Rosenblum stated on Monday, and quote, "Oregon has consistently exceeded the national average despite the numbers I just shared. We know hate is more complex than the numbers reflected," Rosenblum said. She noted that many hate crimes go unreported due to distrust between vulnerable communities and the police. Some incidents that are reported are not investigated or categorized as hate crimes. We believe here at KBOO that every hate crime should be counted and brought to justice. No hate crime should be taken lightly, and the struggle for marginalized people will only continue if we do not report and discuss these crimes.
2017 was the hottest year on record in our global ocean, according to a new study published in Advances in Atmospheric Sciences. The study used some of the most up-to-date scientific methods of measuring ocean heat. Our oceans absorb 90% of the heat that humans create in the atmosphere by polluting greenhouse gases, meaning they're one of the biggest environmental victims of global warming. This explains why even though 2017 was the second hottest year on record in the air, 2017 was actually the hottest year on record in our oceans.
Angela Davis has a civil rights award rescinded over her support of Palestine. This is the Middle East Minute.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I am Salim Shahadeh. Angela Davis was to be honored by the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and receive the Fred Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award at its annual gala next month. That reward was rescinded by the board of directors because of protests from Zionist organizations and the many Christian Zionists in Alabama who sharply criticized Davis's support for Palestinian liberation and the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel. Davis commented, quote, "I have indeed expressed opposition to policies and practices of the State of Israel, as I expressed similar opposition to U.S. support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine and other discriminatory U.S. policies." She also said, quote, "The rescinding of this invitation was thus not primarily an attack against me, but rather against the spirit of the indivisibility of justice," close quote. In other news, Israel has allocated 300 acres of land near Bethlehem for settlement expansion that would engulf the city. The Israeli occupational authorities proposed a similar plan in the past that was canceled due to international pressure. As of now, the local council of the settlement has built a small outpost in the place of the future expansion, marking their intentions to escalate its construction. Settlements are Jewish-only compounds built in coordination with the Israeli national government and the Israeli occupational forces. International law views the entire West Bank as occupied territory and considers all Israeli settlement building there to be illegal. These settlements are built on stolen Palestinian land, infringing on the right of Palestinian sovereignty and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. The settlements prevent Palestinians from earning their livelihood from the land, and the series of Jewish-only roads that connect the settlements prohibit their movement. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint production of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
France is reporting damage to more than 60% of the nation's speed camera network today. According to Interior Government Minister Christophe Castamer, members of the Yellow Vest movement are responsible. Leaders of the protest movement claim the speed cameras are an extra tax for poor commuters who are priced out of France's urban centers. Cameras were blocked by tape, paint, and physical objects. The Yellow Vest movement, named for the fluorescent traffic vests worn by protesters, was introduced to the international scene in November during massive protests of a fuel tax introduced by President Emmanuel Macron. The widespread damage to the speed camera network follows an announcement on Tuesday by Prime Minister Eduardo Philippe of the government's plan to crack down on, and quote, unsanctioned protests in the future. He threatened to deploy 80,000 members of the security force during the next unauthorized protest. On Monday, Philippe said, and quote, those who question our institutions will not have the last word.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for this Thursday, January the 10th, 2019. Here are the main points one more time. The act of human trafficking, it still continues in 2019 with the conviction of a 31-year-old Portland man. A Green New Deal is in process against fossil fuels in our nation's capital. And in international news, yellow vests hit the streets in France. Will the regulation of their protests be cracked down on? This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ray Bogwell and Emily Gresham Beamer. The producers are Annette Newell and Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Ray Bogwell. The Director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast are available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, Beloved Community talks to Professor Fred Provenza about his book, Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. At 10, Valley Views looks at how the two-party political system thrives while freedom of choice dies. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide analyzes how to use science, medicine, and technology in ways that won't harm us. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
And welcome back to KBOO News In Depth. Immigration, of course, is front and center right now as our country's federal workforce is on hold and a partial government shutdown in the fight over a border wall. However, America, we know, is a country built on immigrants, including many right here in Oregon. Joining us today on KBOO News In Depth, we're happy to have with us the founder of The Immigrant Story, Sankar Rahman, and Jim Lomason, a photographer who has done work on a project called What We Carried. Welcome to both of you. Glad to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sankar, you have just a fascinating story. You immigrated from India. Tell us about that and how you had a long career here in Oregon.
Yes. You know, I always say that I came from India to Indiana to go to graduate school. Since then, I kind of stayed here, and I had a long career in tech industry after getting my PhD from the college in Indiana. So, you know, I lived in, Oregon, Portland, Oregon, for about 15 years now. Before that, I used to have this job which took me back and forth. And then after a while, I thought, you know, it's better to move to Oregon. And we have been here for a while. Yeah, it is very interesting journey. I think, you know, we have seen a lot of things happen over, 38 years of my stay in U.S. I stayed in U.S. longer than I lived in India. This is finally feels like home.
Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners what the immigrant story is and why you started it.
Yeah. Immigrant story is, about telling stories of immigrants, all walks of life. You know, you have people, you come across, our community is growingly diverse now, and we have immigrants of all walks of life. And we really use the immigrants loosely in the sense that we consider everybody who migrated to this country for whatever reasons are the ancestors, who came, who has a story, who came to this country, wherever from, and their stories. And it is about, them, and we take a picture and we start talking about them in words as well, in 600 words, very short stories usually. And the main reason is we wanted to have this dialogue to counteract the very divisive, very, toxic environment we are in today, which is really scapegoating immigrants for whatever reasons as a way to get political power and political gain. In the process, they have been singled out. And what we are trying to do is we are trying to provide a counter narrative. It is really about, telling their stories and say what they do and how they survive, what their life has been.
Now, Jim, you've had a project you worked on called What We Carried, Fragments and Memories from Iraq and Syria. Tell us what you've done with that and how people can learn more about this.
Well, when I first started this project, I had just finished a book about returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. And in the course of my interviews with the soldiers, I thought I should interview someone from Iraq. And I interviewed a woman in Portland, and in the course of our interview, I asked her about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, and she said, "I thank America for removing Saddam Hussein, but did you have to destroy my entire country to do that?" So that planted a seed that I needed to hear more of the story. And it really isn't the other side of the story. It's just more of the story. And so I started working with Iraqi refugees in Portland and then eventually traveled America, and I kept interviewing refugees, but I needed a way to help them tell their own stories rather than have an interview and a portrait. And so I started photographing those few things that people brought with them. And when you leave under the cover of darkness during a war with a kid under each arm and a few objects, you can only take so much. And so I asked people if I could photograph those few things that they brought with them. And then I made a bigger photograph of that object, and I asked the participant to write why that thing was so important that they chose that above everything else. And so it's not about photography, it's about storytelling, and I'm the conduit for their stories. And they put their own words in their own hand on those photographs, and they're really powerful pictures and stories.
Now, you're working with The Immigrant Story in Portland.
Tell us all about that.
Yeah, you know, we decided to collaborate on a particular project, which we call it as To Bear Witness. It is about the survivors of Holocaust and genocides. You know, we picked specific events, and what we are going to do, what we have been doing so far, is to talk to the survivors who have really been in the middle of these big events like Holocaust or some of the big genocides. And we interview them. We write our part, which we write stories. And Jim does his part, which is about the objects they carry. Together, we thought it would be a beautiful way of showing the people not only visual narratives of them, as well as, you know, literal narratives, but also the objects they brought, you know, what it means to them, to a variety of ways of telling the same story.
Yeah, and, you know, by collaborating like this, you know, we're both doing projects that are fundamentally collaborative with the participants, and now we have a bigger collaborative project with our two projects. And I did a project in Chicago called Stories of Survival, Object, Image, and Memory, and that was a project with Holocaust and genocide survivors, and we included 8 genocides. And again, it was objects that had either survived the Holocaust or Rwanda or Bosnia or Cambodia. And those stories, again, are so powerful and intimate and human that I think as we combine these projects, and our first venue for this project will be the Oregon Jewish Museum in Portland, and then we'll continue to do more around the country.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, where you and when we can see these this exhibit.
And I also, you know, with what we carried, the Arab American National Museum has been traveling the exhibition, and I've done a number of new projects in various cities in the U.S. This summer, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, what we carried is going to be exhibited at the Ellis Island Immigration Museum. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably the best place in the world for a project about refugees and immigrants to be exhibited, because people will bring their families from all over America. They might come there looking for their own ancestors, and they might even be wearing red hats. Mm-hmm. And they'll see, 500,000 people will see this exhibition.
And another new project you have is called In To Bear Witness. What is the focus of that?
Yeah, you know, it is, you know, this is the same project we are talking about. This is, you know, again, like Jim was saying, there's going to be very specific genocides, and these folks are actually survivors. You know, the importance of it is very, very, very clear, is that, you know, for example, we had about 40 Holocaust survivors in Oregon at one time, when these folks went to different schools and started telling about their stories. And right now, today, there is only one survivor remaining. And, you know, they are all aging. You know, Cambodians, you know, the killing fields, you know, one of the stories that we want to do, there are very few survivors in this town we want to go to. And, you know, so our goal is to catch them and to, you know, as the name indicates, to bear witness to their testimony and really try to have their stories accessible to everybody. So it will be in a public exhibition starting 2020. October is when it will go on public display. And like Jim was saying, it will go first in Oregon Jewish Museum. After that, it will travel the nation, you know, hopefully. And we are going to test drive it, you know, just to see how it's all coming out in April in Oregon Historic Society, to one story that will be a survivor from Rohingya community, who is one of the very few Rohingya survivor in town. And we are going to showpiece that one in April along with the story. We will test, you know, drive it, so to speak, you know, how it's all coming together. And then we will go to a bigger show in 2020.
Yeah, there's another exhibit called Our Community, Our Stories. This profiles immigrants right here, mm-hmm. immigrants and refugees from Hillsboro, Oregon. Give us a preview of what that's going to be about.
Yeah, and you know, as you know probably, Hillsboro, Oregon is one of the most diverse community we have in Oregon as a city. You know, we have a diverse community because of the tech industry, because of the migrant farm workers. The society, the community is really big now. You know, what we want to do is to showcase 8 stories of 8 folks coming from various countries, various communities, various races, and we are going to showcase this one in one place to see. You know, this is how our community looks like today. You know, it is very diverse, and these folks are here making a living and calling it home, and they make this society and community as a vibrant place to live, and that's what it's going to be. It's starting on Tuesday, 15th, and it will be there in the Civic Center until the end of April, and we will be addressing the city council to the mayors, and people will be talking, and there will be more announcements to come in February.
Do you think the climate for immigrants is less friendly in the U.S. now than in past years?
I would say so, because, you know, in my 38 years of stay in U.S., I think the 2016 election cycle, where they have made immigrants as a scapegoat and using that, you know, as a really in a pounding bag, so to speak, right, to get political power is new, mm-hmm. I think. You know, we were never like this, right, before. And one community, especially the immigrants of color, has been targeted. And I think, you know, it is sad. But, you know, you can see because of that consequences what happened even in our own Portland. You know, on the day of inauguration, you saw, you know, Muslim woman, a girl was traveling mm-hmm. in a bus. You know, her hijab was pulled. You know, there was, you know, 4-month-old baby girl was traveling from Dubai to come here for heart surgery. She was stopped, you know, because of the Trump Muslim ban. Things like that happen, you know, and then it ended up with a big event, you know, I don't know whether to call it an event, but Max incident where, you know, 3 people were attacked, 2 of them died. And all those things happen in our own city, even though it seemed like it is quiet, but underneath it all, we still see the brunt of the force. The people are taking that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What to each of you, I'd like an answer from both of you on this question. What do you think about the standoff over immigration from Mexico leading to the partial government shutdown that's underway right now? Jim?
I think it's part of this big picture that Sankar was talking about. It's racist, and you know what we need to do, and I think what we're trying to do with our projects is show how similar we all are, how human we all are in our diversity, but we all want the same things. We want shelter over our heads. We want safety. We want our children to go to school. And on a hot day, we want our kids to have an ice cream cone. And with our projects, it does, and I hate to use the word humanize, because the refugees and immigrants and undocumented workers are already human. We're the ones that need to be humanized. And by doing these projects and showing things with my project, what we carried, you know, we see things that are from the Middle East that we would expect, teapots and teacups and candle holders, and then Barbie dolls and teddy bears mm-hmm. and things. And I saw that with the project in Chicago too, with Holocaust and genocide survivors, a teddy bear that was buried in the backyard in 1938 before the family escaped, that was then exhumed after the war. And so when we see these common things, we realize, yeah, we're not that different. And so I think these projects help to do that, and it's an ongoing effort. And I think if we can, you know, finally realize how similar we all are, I think that's, you know, that can bring some.
Mm-hmm. And Sankar, what do you think of this, the standoff over immigration leading to the shutdown?
It is very sad, right? You know, this border wall, border crisis, you know, creating a wall and curtailing the human migration, which happened, you know, thousands of years in the southern borders. I lived in New Mexico for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know the economy and how it worked there. You know, to putting an artificial wall, it is something. But then tomorrow, you know, there are 800 to almost nearly 1 million people not getting paycheck over it. You know, it is really affecting mm-hmm. those families tomorrow. They are not going to get a paycheck. In my opinion, you know, the artificial wall is like border itself is a Second World War aftermath of it, you know, thing. And I want to go opposite to it. I would like to see in North America, like European Union, where we don't have a border. We migrate fluently, you know, both ways, go up and down. If you can imagine the economy, you know, that will be bigger than any economy ever. Nobody can touch us. You know, that's what I want to see. That's what it was before. People migrated, you know, from all over the place. And that's the way it should be. And I think it's a political game. And really, the people are struggling there. You know, it's going to hurt somebody's, purse tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, starting tomorrow.
Starting tomorrow.
Yeah. And how can people find out more about your projects?
Yeah, you know, one thing, you know, for us, you know, ours are, if you go to theimmigrantstory.org, and there is events page there, you can see all our current events posted up there. And we also have a Facebook group, Facebook page. And you can come there and like us, and we will have events always. We usually do one event a month. And
you can go to the Immigrant Stories, and you can find what we carry there, too. Or you can, I think it's whatwecarried.com. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's okay.
Yes. You know, these projects are pretty visible, and Sankar has done an amazing job and seems to have a machine, and mm-hmm. he's very well organized, and he has editors and writers and tech mm-hmm. people, and so he really has put together an amazing website and project, and so that's a great portal.
Yeah, well, Jim, I think you've done an amazing job. I was looking at some of the stuff that you have online as well, and you know, you must have a favorite story or something you might be able to share with us about. Give us your best shot. One of your favorite stories you did about a refugee.
Well, let me read one Portland Iraqi refugee, mm-hmm. Ali, and he brought his Iraqi flag, just a little pendant, and I asked him to write something, mm-hmm. and he wrote this poem. He wrote, "I want to ask my country, Iraq, when will we get some rest? Shall we spend tears on our current circumstance, or should we cry for the past? We have been carrying our misery for a long time on our chests. Strangers from around the world occupied our land, and they kill our people for a very cheap price. We are tired, and we want to get some rest."
Wow.
And I think that's such a beautiful, succinct statement of having mm-hmm. to leave your homeland
wow.
and your culture and your friends and your university, and he would love to go back to Iraq.
So emotional. How about, Sankar, I know you have done so many amazing stories about immigrants in our community. Can mm-hmm. you showcase one of them for us
yeah,
that stands out to you?
I think, you know, it is tough. You know, we have done about 70 stories so far in 1.5 years, and it is like asking a parent, you know, pick a favorite child.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to do, right?
Do
but,
no.
You know, the stories, you know, goes, you know, bunch of different ways. You know, it touches upon different things. You know, there is a lot of heartwarming stories. You know, most of my stories that I really, you know, tend to, you know, think about it a lot or touch me are the Iraq, you know, are the refugee stories, you know, where you know, people leave their country, you know, in some cases walk to another country, stay in a refugee camp for a long time without a future, and then come here to United States and then make a new living and make it really big. You know, there are several of them. Last week we published a story about Bermundi, person. You know, she escaped, young girl, you know, 22 or something. So, you know, you get emotional.
Yeah. I think I see some tears in your eyes there. My too. I'm thinking of just the human cost of being a refugee or an immigrant that you come up against all the time.
Oh yeah, and you know, I've talked to one Iraqi refugee had a Polaroid of his family. I'm sorry, of a fellow student at his university, and he put ink on his hand and he smeared it across the photograph. And he basically said, you know, it was about college. And he said, this is about a future that will never come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So wow. Sad. Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's so powerful. And I know that we spoke beforehand, and I had the privilege of being able to get recordings of young students who were also a part of the storytelling I think it was like a line about Multnomah County downtown, and it was late in the evening, and it was just so powerful to hear these young people and to see them facilitating an entire group of adults on how to tell stories. And the biggest thing, the theme of the night was empathy and how to step into someone else's shoes with full empathy with their story. And if you could, what would you like to say about the students, if you were able to go, and about young people trying to be a part of the conversation of empathy in order to make a difference?
It is a lot of young folks, right, when they come, especially if you are coming from a different country like I was, you know, not that young, but I was 20 something when I came here. You have a sense of belonging issues, you know, identity question, all those questions come to you, and you start to doubt about yourself, and then you start to think about, do I really belong here? Can I ever get a piece of this American dream, the so-called American dream? And all those questions comes to you, and I think what I would tell them is, I think you should still believe that you could make your own story. You could charter your own course, and have faith in yourself and try to make it work. People like me who had made it, is a testimony. Testament for anybody else can make it. I'm not that special. I think if I can make it, I think anybody else could as well. And I think that's what I would tell the young people.
Wonderful. No, I have to disagree. You all are special. Awesome. And y'all have done an amazing job. Like, you should be so proud of yourselves. And I just have to say that.
A lot of time.
A little 2 cents.
It's true. Nobody can dispute that. Yeah. And Portland in general, I think we're proud in terms of being inviting and welcoming. And Portlanders overwhelmingly voted to protect the sanctuary city status in the midterm election. What did you think about that result, and does that give you some hope for the future, Jim?
I'm always happy. I live in Portland.
Right.
And, I do a lot of traveling, and I'm often in red states. And, I'm always so grateful when I come home, and I know, Oregon isn't perfect. We have a pretty ugly history of racism, I think we are trying to do the right thing, and we're pretty progressive, but it's still, we need an education ourselves too. Mm-hmm. So
totally,
yeah, and that's something that seems to be coming under attack from this administration. Basically, they're saying you can't decide to be a sanctuary city.
I think it is very important, for progressive, cities like Portland, even though, like you said, it is not all great, it is not, we have our own past history. But nonetheless, though, if you look at, we have about 8 DACA stories in our website. Mm-hmm. If you read about the stories of these young people, all of them are young, and you would see what is needed to protect them. They have, this is pretty much their home, and they're growing up in here, right? So you have to do something. So I think we are doing the right thing. And I think I'm grateful that we are living in Oregon, we are living in Portland, that that provides this kind of protection. And I think we need to continue doing that.
Mm-hmm. You know. And can I say just one more?
Sure.
I did a project with the Yazidi community that is now living in Lincoln, Nebraska. And the Yazidis were victims of ISIS, and it was an industrial, you know, genocide and industrial rape and trafficking, mm-hmm. and it was an effort to exterminate a whole religious sect in northern Iraq. And there's 3,000 Yazidis living in Lincoln, Nebraska. And the city has reached out. And when I do these projects, there's often some media attention, and so maybe it's a local TV station. So the news at 5:30, that Lincoln, Nebraska town gets to see a project about their local refugee community that they didn't know about. And people reach out. They offer ESL classes. They offer furniture. The Yazidi people are getting jobs, and it's you know, middle America, the flyover states, but it's kind of the America that we want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, America's really been built on immigration and immigrants. Why do you think that this issue keeps coming up again and again, the resistance to immigrants, to new people?
I think, you know, if you go back to even old days, right, you know, we have heard stories about even Irish people were called, mm-hmm. you know, names. Italians were mm-hmm. called names. Jewish people have been called names. And, you know, I think, you know, those days it was more, you know, economic reasons. Maybe I don't know what it was exactly. But nonetheless, it was others, right? It's a question of others, us versus them. Somehow they are different and they're taking away our, you know, stuff. Basically encroaching on our community, what mm-hmm. have you. But I think this time is different. You know, it is a targeted attempt towards the immigrants of color because they are loosely organized or not at all organized. So it's an easy target for political gain. And the base wants to hear this, and, you know, all your problems are blamed on these people because they are, you know, doing this or that or taking away from your job, what have you. And I think it's a political narrow-mindedness, and it is hopefully it will be a passing thing. But if we just stand by and watch this one happen and being an innocent bystanders, you know, it's not the right way to approach it. We have to stand up and say, no, it's not the right thing to do. Otherwise, it can go out of control. You know, where is the next, what is the next thing? You know, are we going down the path of internment? Are we going down the path of other extreme actions that have happened against mm-hmm. the minority groups? So we really need to be careful about these times when these kind of things happen. We have to say, we have to stand up, we have to, you know, do something about it.
Yeah, and Jim, I know with your travels overseas and you've seen some people in horrible situations somehow survive. Does that give you a cautionary tale for what could happen in America?
You know, my project really has been about the people that have come to America. And so most of the people that I've interviewed and worked with are in America. Mm-hmm. But I've heard their stories. And, you know, all these projects, I mean, in a way, every one of the projects that I do is like getting another college degree in another subject. Mm-hmm. And so I learn so much. But you know, the project with that we're working on right now, I just picked up some of the pieces that a Holocaust survivor had written on the photographs. And while I was with her in her apartment, she's a 91-year-old woman, she gave me a roll of Donald Trump toilet paper. and you know, this is a 91-year-old Holocaust survivor.
What a statement that was, huh?
But she really understands the threat. Mm-hmm. And when I was working with Holocaust survivors, you know, they talked about Hitler, and they talked about it, one person talked about it in a metaphorical way as a storm coming. Mm-hmm. And I think people that have been through genocide and the Holocaust, they really understand the threat. And, you know, we have to remind ourselves that, you know, Donald Trump didn't create the base. Mm-hmm. The base was always there.
Yes.
Donald Trump just green-lighted it. Mm. And so we have to do all we can to make a big change.
Totally. And that was my next question was, well, what else do you think needs to happen in order to create equity for immigrants? I think that Donald Trump toilet paper is totally fine. As long as we all get on one accord,
right,
I think that
that's
a fine way of getting through it by me. You also bring a sense of like shutting things down, like protesting. And would you like to speak more on that?
I personally call myself as a passive activist, in the sense that, we don't necessarily, I guess we are, at least I feel like I'm too old to go and protest, I don't feel like going to be a radical person at my age. But nonetheless, though, I think what we are trying to do is to educate and try to provide a visual, counter narrative.
Okay, well, Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us, Sankar and Jim.
All right.
We really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The time is 6 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the film screening From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation, on Thursday, January 10th at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. From Shock to Awe follows the path of two combat veterans from the Iraq War as they live with post-traumatic lack of effective treatment and their search for healing and transformation through plant medicine journeys. Again, that's the film screening From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation, on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland.